When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're laughing, when you're laughing.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The human face contains 42 individual muscles, facial muscles, making for a seemingly endless combination of expressions. They are what enable us to communicate the subtle difference between dismay and disgust, shock and amazement, right? But not so fast, says a study from the University of Glasgow. It turns out that our faces, as expressive as they may be, can convey only 4 basic emotions. Here to fill us in on that study and on others we may have missed this week is Elizabeth Landau. She's a health writer and producer for CNN.com. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's talk about those facial expressions. That's really hard to imagine. I was sort of playing with my face last night trying to make lots of different expressions. But scientists have previously thought that there were just 6 expressions everyone in the world could identify. What were those and what have we whittled them down to now?
Right, yeah. So basically the thinking has been that with our faces, we can typically show happiness, sadness, fear, anger, surprise, and disgust. But these researchers basically created models of faces and looked at, you know, if you were to manipulate just individual facial muscles, you know, could people really tell the difference between different expressions? And they found that fear and disgust sort of share commonalities. Like when you wrinkle your nose, it's hard to tell if that's a fear or disgust gesture. Or, you know, when you widen your eyes, that could be fear or surprise. So the message of the study is sort of that there may be even fewer concrete emotions that we can express than we thought. And, you know, it's important to note that this study was done in Glasgow, but, you know, if you were to take it to other cultures, it would be interesting to see what the outcome would be.
Yeah, it's interesting that the key or the common denominator happens to be fear. You know what I mean? Between disgust and surprise. So there's this element of fear and surprise and disgust. I'm
definitely,
just...
Definitely, yeah. I mean, one might speculate that, you know, in evolutionary terms, you know, our ancestors, you know, they needed to survive in the wild. And, you know, in order to communicate to others that there was a danger coming, they might have needed to express fear urgently.
So can you talk a little bit more about how they measured these emotions on people? They found people who are special in that they can control all of those different muscles?
That's right. And I had never heard of this phenomenon before, but the article says that there are people who are super facers who can actually, they are trained to control the individual muscles in the face. There are 42 of them. You know, most people can't do this, but apparently, you know, there are those out there who can train themselves to do it. And, you know, based on those people, the researchers created a computer model of, you know, what would it look like if a person, you know, just flexed each individual muscle.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Elizabeth Landau. She's a health writer and producer for CNN.com. If you have a question about this, we're going to be talking about some other studies coming up. 614-292-8513. So you mentioned the question of whether it's cross-cultural, and it is hard to imagine that everyone in the world, you know, different cultures have the same expressions.
Right, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, an area of research that is certainly quite interesting, and we'll just kind of have to see what happens.
So let's talk about darkness and hearing, and it's another study you wrote about was the relationship between darkness and the hearing ability in mice. Tell us about that and how it relates to humans.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you've ever been in a dark room. I actually went to this exhibit called Dialogue in the Dark, where it simulates the experience of blindness, and they take you through this different set of scenarios that that one would go through in life, like in a grocery store and things like that, and what that would be like without being able to see, and it really forced you to use your other senses, hearing and touch. And at the end of that experience, you get to actually drink, a Coke or another soda. And, the guide tells you that, you may actually experience that in a more sensory way and in a stronger way, because when your sense of sight is removed, everything else, all your other senses might seem more heightened to you. Mm-hmm. And I kind of kept that in the back of my mind when I was reading this study. The study was done in mice, and basically the mice were put in a very dark setting, and the researchers found that they were able to hear better and even tell pitches and frequencies apart better. So, the philosophy here is that, the brain is plastic. It can compensate for the loss of one sense by making other ones even stronger.
Right. And prior evidence showed that there wasn't much hope of strengthening auditory connections in adult brains, but this study suggests otherwise. So this is a sort of a practical application that they're looking at.
Definitely. And of course, it is in mice. Mice are different than humans. But, mm-hmm. One might imagine that this could teach us even more about how our brain works and perhaps, lead to treatment.
Then you also looked at a study about the HPV vaccine and the sexual habits of early sex among young girls. The HPV, of course, is a human papilloma virus vaccine. And there had been concern among some people that if you gave this vaccine to girls, younger girls, it would encourage them to engage in sexual activity earlier than they otherwise would. It'd be sort of a permission kind of. But a new study says that's not true. What do we know?
That's right. So as you said, there was this fear that, giving very young girls the HPV vaccine would encourage them to be more promiscuous. But, based on this study, that's not true. These girls aged 13 to 21 completed surveys about their sexual activity immediately after they got the vaccine, and then 2 months later, and then 6 months later. And the researchers found that these girls' sexual activity really didn't change as a result of getting the vaccine. It didn't seem like anybody, as soon as they got the vaccine, became more promiscuous than they otherwise would. And it also didn't change how they felt about safe sex. Obviously this is just one study. It's based on surveys. More research needs to be done, but it's definitely an argument against those who say that the vaccine would result in more promiscuous behavior.
Right. So it dealt with that question. Is there any suggestion that it makes people, or at least the subjects that they looked at, less promiscuous than they would have without having it? In other words, when you're getting a vaccine for something that's transmitted through sexual content or contact, it makes you think?
I don't think so. I mean, it just said that their perceptions of how likely they were to get an STD did not change.
Okay.
Their sexual activity didn't change the way that they thought about their sex. It really didn't change. It doesn't seem like it had much of an effect at all.
So has it had any impact at all on the people who thought that the vaccine would encourage promiscuous behavior? Or are there still people out there who are worried about it?
I haven't heard anything specifically, but, again, it's only one study. It is in a major journal, Pediatrics, mm-hmm. Remains to be seen whether this will be, whether this will really change the minds of anybody.
Now, turning to yogurt and diabetes, if you're not lactose intolerant, yogurt, they found in a study in the UK that people who eat yogurt are less likely to get diabetes. How do they have any idea why?
The theory here is that yogurt has lots of good ingredients, such as calcium, magnesium, vitamin D and fatty acids, and something about all of that, maybe some other component of yogurt, may help people prevent diabetes. I have to say that it's very, very difficult to prove that any food causes any effect, because, you know, when you think about it, everybody eats a wide variety of things every day. It's really hard to isolate one thing that you eat every day as having a particular effect. But it was interesting that they looked at, 753 people with type 2 diabetes compared to 3,500 healthy people. So that is a lot in terms of the sample size.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting. We should also note that it was done in Norfolk, England. So it's, you know, restricted to that geographic area, and more research would need to be done to see, you know, could they find the same effect in other populations?
They tested for other kinds of non-fermented dairy and didn't find the same diabetes risk lowering correlation, at least. So maybe it's something to do with probiobiotics?
It's certainly possible, but, they were not able to isolate what ingredient in yogurt is having this effect.
Okay. Did the scientists test for plain yogurt versus fruit, or what kind of yogurt? Because there's a lot of junk in a lot of yogurts now.
I'm not quite sure. I mean, I know that this was low-fat yogurt, but again, I think you would need to do a more controlled study to see, you know, exactly what kinds of yogurt people are eating, how often, things like that.
Okay. Then real quick, we have one more to talk about. It's about heat-related deaths. There was a study from England that predicted that by 2050, heat-related deaths will skyrocket. What is the study for, and why did it suggest that?
Climate change is one of the major issues of our time. And as our planet warms, temperatures will rise on average around the world. And so areas that you wouldn't think of as being a particular risk of heat death, like the United Kingdom, actually, according to this study, will see a significant rise in heat death, particularly in the elderly population of people 75 years and older. At the same time, the population of elderly people in the UK is projected to grow significantly. So that also contributes to this effect.
Is it just heat exhaustion that we're talking about, or are there other dangers and risks from a hotter climate?
Heat stroke, heat exhaustion are all dangerous, especially for elderly people.
Uh-huh.
I should also note that right now there are about 2,000 excess summer deaths in the UK compared to 41,000 winter-related deaths. So actually, winter-related deaths are currently a bigger issue. But the study points out that, by 2050, heat deaths will also continue to be a significant issue, and even at a greater magnitude.
All right. Well, Elizabeth Landau, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Landau, she's a health writer and producer for CNN.com. Coming up, we're going to talk about testosterone replacement therapies, the pros and the cons. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When a man turns 30, his testosterone levels tend to decrease about 1% a year. Some call it aging, some call it menopause, and some call it a crisis that only hormones can fix. In the past decade, the number of men taking replacement testosterone has quadrupled. But recent studies have shown that the risks for most of these men far outweigh any benefits. For more on this, we're joined by Dr. Bradley Anawalt. He's an endocrinologist at the University of Washington Medical Center, and he's on the phone from Seattle. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me on the show.
So what happens when a man has low levels of testosterone, or when the testosterone levels start to decrease? What's the deal?
Well, we need to distinguish two different circumstances. There are a large group of men out there with a disease that affects the pituitary, the master gland of the brain, that regulates the production of testosterone from the testicles, or they may have a disease or an abnormality that they're born with that affects the testicles directly so that they can't produce testosterone. And for those men, low testosterone levels lead to decreased sexual function, specifically decreased sex drive and pleasure with sexual activity, decreased bone strength and bone mass, leading to increased risk of fractures, decreased muscle mass, may lead to behavioral changes where they feel more irritable or less able to focus. So that's one group of men. The larger group of men that you've invited me to talk about today is the group of men that as they age, their testosterone levels tend to decline. Part of that's probably a physiological effect of aging, and part of that is related to the fact that as men age, they tend to gain fat, and fat is associated with decreased testosterone levels. So for men that have low testosterone levels related to aging, we really don't have the answer as to whether or not that drop in testosterone level is causing significant health effects. So there's a group of doctors out there that say, we think that those men might benefit from testosterone therapy, and there's another group that say, wait a minute, we're not sure. We need to do more studies.
So when we're talking about clinically low testosterone, we're talking about that large group of men with diseases that affect pituitary gland and the first group you talked about.
Yeah, it's the group that has a disease that affects the pituitary or the testicles directly.
And then the other group, they're just through age and maybe by gaining weight too, by aging, or as they age, are experiencing some of the same symptoms as that other group.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, when I rattled off the fact that men with real diseases that affect their testosterone level, I said their bone strength goes
right.
down, their muscle strength goes down, their sexual function goes down. That sounds a lot like natural aging. So that's what's led to this, you know, controversy about whether or not men might benefit from testosterone therapy as they get older.
Okay. And you were the author of a study of veterans that found that testosterone replacement can be very helpful to those of them with low T. What's that? Oh, low testosterone. Tell us about what you studied and what you learned.
Well, the study that we did was intended to take a look at a very large group of veteran men who had been diagnosed with hypogonadism, which is the medical condition where you have a disease that causes a decrease in your testosterone level, and then were treated with testosterone for some period of time. And it was really designed to look at whether or not this was safe. And in our study, we showed that men who had been treated with testosterone did not have an increased risk of heart attacks or strokes. In fact, there tended to be a lower early mortality, meaning that the men who were treated with testosterone didn't die as early as the men that were not treated with testosterone. Now, we did not conclude, and I don't want anybody in the audience to conclude, that meant that testosterone allowed people to live longer. We just concluded that this suggested that in the circumstances where we're giving testosterone to men with real disease, that it's not harmful in terms of strokes, heart attacks, and early death.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Brad Annewalt. He's an endocrinologist at the University of Washington Medical Center, and we're talking about the pros and cons of testosterone replacement therapy. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the guys that are in that group that have disease-related low testosterone, it sounds like they could be having these symptoms, if it's disease-related, when they're younger.
Well, that's often true. There's a large group of boys that are born with a congenital disorder called Klinefelter syndrome, and it's in about 1 in 500 boys. So those boys may have symptoms much earlier. They may have delayed puberty. They may have symptoms of decreased concentration. They may have early fractures long before you would expect them to. So those boys actually may declare themselves early. But men may develop pituitary disease or a testicular disease at any time in their lives. Pituitary tumors crop up when you're 30, 40, 50, 60 years old, and you kind of trauma to the testicles. You can have surgery to the area supplying the blood to the testicles, which can cause problems. So these things can all occur at any time in a man's life. But you're right. The ones that have congenital abnormalities, but that is those born with it, they'll tend to have these symptoms early.
And so the question of the pros and the cons, the risk factors change for them, don't they?
Oh, yeah. No, it's clear that, again, that those people with a real disease, they have a benefit. You give them testosterone, they feel better, their bone strength gets better, their muscle strength gets better, their sexual function improves. But really underlying all this, and I think what many of the men in the audience might be curious about is, hey, I'm a 40-year-old man, and I'm not feeling so good. I've gone in and got my testosterone level checked, and it's a little low. Should I take testosterone?
Mm-hmm.
And as a general rule of thumb, the answer is no. You need to have a thoughtful evaluation by your doctor. But most of those men tend to be sedentary. They are not exercising properly. They're not eating healthfully. And by exercising more, you can raise your testosterone levels. And many of these men don't have an underlying disease that's causing mm-hmm. a problem with their testosterone.
And there's a natural decrease in testosterone. Is there any danger in monkeying with that?
Well, when you phrase it like that, it's always dangerous to monkey
Sorry,
around with
monkeying
health.
Sorry, monkeying is a loaded word. Okay.
No, that's fine. You know, the truth of the matter is I think we really just flat out don't know. And,
okay.
and the concern is, and I'm not the only physician who's raised this concern, is that we're entering into a modern era of snake oil dispensation where people are being prescribed testosterone really for the desired effect of maintaining youthfulness or improving their appearance or their performance. And we're really quite concerned that one shouldn't prescribe or take testosterone for trivial reasons. I mean, it should be, and I'm not trying to say it's trivial to look good and have bigger muscles, but that's not the reason to take testosterone. So you really have to have an underlying problem.
And it has to have a therapeutic purpose to it.
A therapeutic purpose to it, yeah,
okay.
Fair enough.
All right. Roger in Worthington, you're on the air with Dr. Bradley Annawalt.
Yes, I've been diagnosed with low T, and exhaustion and things like that is what the doctor associated with it. I've been using Androgel, but it ends up having the difficulty of grandchildren and having them around and making sure that nobody comes in contact with the gel. And I was wondering, I had just seen in checking with my medical insurance that there is a pill available. Are there any advantages or disadvantages to the pill versus the gel? And I'll take my answer offline.
Okay, Roger. Brad, could you first tell us what the problems are with the gel that Roger was talking about?
Yeah, Roger's alluding to an important aspect of testosterone therapy. Most men in the United States, when they're started on testosterone, are given a testosterone gel or a cream these days. And the reason for that is that testosterone, although you can take it by mouth, it's very quickly metabolized by the liver. So we give it in a formulation that goes across the skin so it doesn't immediately go to the liver and get broken down.
Okay.
And when you apply a testosterone product to your skin, it sits on the skin for a little while and can be transferred to anybody that you're having intimate physical contact with. You could be holding, if you apply it to your chest or your shoulder and you hold a baby, that baby could be exposed then to testosterone.
Okay.
If you apply the gel and wash the area half an hour or so later, all of that gel that's sitting on top of the skin will be gone. And you won't prevent absorption if you allow it to sit there for 10, 15, 20 minutes. And then, of course, if you wear clothing, if you wear a T-shirt or something over the area mm-hmm. where you apply the gel, that also ensures that there's a barrier between you and anybody you might touch. So if you take proper precautions, you can avoid the effects of giving testosterone to a woman or a baby and making them hairy or making a baby boy turn. Well, no, it's really true. I mean, you got little baby boys that start going through puberty.
Oh, so. Really? Because of that? They found that? Oh, okay. I'm laughing. Well, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I mean, and female partners that start developing facial hair and acne and so forth. So it doesn't happen a lot, but it happens enough that we raise that concern. Roger asked about the pill.
Right.
And in the United States, there is not a pill available for the treatment of hypogonadism or conditions with low testosterone. In Europe and Canada, there's a pill that's available that you have to take at least two or three times a day. And it's generally reserved for men with testosterone levels that are only slightly low. There's a lot of interest, and people are going to be reading about in the newspapers and magazines or hearing about it on radio or television shows about another pill that is being tested by a drug company that's really primarily targeted towards men that have normal testosterone production from their testicles, but they lack the stimulus from the brain. And it's too early now to make any comments about whether that pill will work.
The one that you talked about that's available in Canada, is that the pill that there's concern about it being absorbed through the liver?
Well, so now I'm so glad you asked that question. That's a totally different issue. That's the pill that bodybuilders and athletes and those who are abusing what we call anabolic androgenic steroids, those are pills that have testosterone that's been modified chemically or a testosterone-related compound that has all the effects of testosterone or most of the effects of testosterone, but it's been chemically modified so that when you take it by mouth, it goes through the liver and the liver can't break it down. And that's great if you want to have something in your body acting for a long time. The problem is that these particular modified testosterone compounds are toxic to the liver and can cause liver damage. So we really discourage ordering those drugs. They are available through websites and other illicit sources, and so we really strongly discourage anybody from ordering those particular compounds.
John in Upper Arlington, you're on the air with Dr. Bradley Anawalt. Welcome, John.
Hi, Dr. Anawalt. I was wondering, I've read about some of these hormones, and you know, it's incredible how small the quantity can be in, say, drinking water to have effects on people. One drop in 10 Olympic swimming pools, that kind of incredibly small quantity leads me to wonder, with these pharmaceutical companies and labs creating all of these hormones, they're being taken by people, and inevitably a lot of that ends up getting back into the rivers and into our drinking water. What responsibility do you think the drug companies and labs have for additional costs that may be required to clean up our drinking water down the road if we go down this path?
So, Brad, is that a concern to begin with?
Well, John's brought up something that's important. It's a broader issue than testosterone. It's really the issue of disposal of all man-made chemicals and drugs. In general, testosterone and estrogen and other steroid hormones, when they're in very small quantities, like you mentioned, a drop in 10 Olympic pools, they don't cause problems with adults or even babies. The controversy that's circulating around right now, and it's really not related to testosterone, but products that are either produced by humans for production of plastics and other commonly used household goods, those things may have actions that are like estrogen and testosterone, and in very small quantities, there's been a concern that they might be associated with long-term health consequences for the developing fetus, so a baby that's exposed to these things.
Like what?
Well, the concern has been, and you know, this is an unproven hypothesis, but the concern has been, and this has received a lot of press, that compounds that are found in plastics, like in water bottles.
Oh, okay.
That they may, if you're the mom is drinking out of the plastic or using something has these compounds and she has a baby, that that may affect the developing baby and give long-term bad effects, which include perhaps increasing the risk of cancer or abnormal development of sexual organs and other health mm-hmm. consequences.
Okay. All right, John, thanks for bringing that up. We appreciate it. Davil and Bexley?
Yeah. I am a biology research student here at Capital University, and for my endocrinology class, I did some research on andropause and adrenopause, and I was wondering whether you could elaborate on whether there is an equivalent to menopause in males with, adrenopause with the adrenal organs not secreting hormones, and whether you think it's comparable or whether it needs to be treated the same way some of the way menopause is treated in females, and just wondering your opinion on that.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, I'm delighted to take that question. No, men do not go through the equivalent of menopause.
Thank you.
everybody says thank you on that one, right? But Anne started the program off with an allusion to menopause or
right.
andropause, and it's an important distinguish between the two. So menopause is a well-described condition that all women, if they live long enough, will go through, and it's a five-year transition from when they make normal amounts of estrogen and they're having normal monthly menstrual cycles to when their estrogen levels drop down to very low levels. Men do not have a transition of 3 to 5 years. As you alluded to at the very beginning, Anne, some are around age 30 to 35. Testosterone levels tend to decline somewhere between 0.5% and 1% per year, and that goes on really for the duration of the man's life. Interestingly enough, those men that are active and maintain physical fitness and good health tend to actually not have this decline in testosterone. So it may not be completely a byproduct of aging per se, but it may be the effects of aggregate poor health over time that tends to cause the testosterone levels to decline. So we discourage the notion at this point, without further more information, of treating andropause, quote unquote, mm-hmm. this age-related decline in testosterone. Just as we discourage giving hormone therapy to women who go through menopause mm-hmm. on a routine basis, it's certainly something we do for 3 to 5 years, but we don't give all women estrogen for the remainder of their lives. So it's really analogous at this point to men. We don't know about the effects of age-related declines in testosterone, and until we get more information, it's not something we naturally prescribe.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it. We have more callers, but we don't have any more time, and I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much, and have a great day.
You too. Dr. Bradley Anawalt, he's an endocrinologist at the University of Washington Medical Center. More coming up on Wellness Wednesday. We're going to talk about the Olympic diet and if it makes us all Olympians or helps us at all. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 3 fried egg sandwiches, 3 chocolate chip pancakes, 4 slices of French toast, a bowl of grits, 1 5-egg omelet, and that was just breakfast for Michael Phelps. Phelps swam his way to victory at the 2008 Beijing Olympics, eating 12,000 calories a day. The athletes competing in Sochi are also concerned with fueling the machines that will win them the gold, in other words, their bodies. But it takes more than just calories to keep anybody in high-performance gear, even if you're just hitting the bunny slopes. Here to tell us what non-Olympians can learn from Olympic diets is Jeff Olson. He's a 2-time former Olympic skier and nutrition expert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. It's good to be here.
Is there much overlap in sports nutrition and nutrition for general health, or is there a lot more muscle milk if you're training for a race?
Well, I guess the urban myth is that somehow Olympic athletes and elite athletes have this really unique diet. The reality is what brings the human body to life, whether you're competing in Sochi or you're a soccer mom or a weekend warrior or a kid or the greatest generation or the next generation, it's all the same. When you go underneath us, we all, we are more alike than we are different. And what brings the body to life is, food is a weapon and it cuts both ways. So the myth is that it's different. The only difference really is in the caloric requirement, which you referenced to Michael Phelps, but there's a bit of a urban myth around that that segment from Beijing as well.
So tell us about the urban myth. I mean, are they being, I read something where they're eating, typically the ones that really use their bodies, 4,000 calories a day.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite common that elite athletes are consuming 5,000 plus calories. I think Michael Phelps was even 9,000 calories a day. And so, the metaphor that I use is the car, and you can't run a high performance car or any car without gasoline and oil. And the gasoline is the fuel, it's the energy, it's the calories, it's the carbs, proteins, and fats that fuel you. But if you try to run your car without oil, things are going to start to go wrong underneath the hood. And we can eat a lot of high caloric foods, like Michael Phelps in that example. However, the oil is actually what helps our body and tissues adapt and rejuvenate and recover. And so the question is not, can a young person eat bad food and perform? Of course they can, but the question is how much better could they be if they understood there was a double-sided coin? There's a gasoline component and an oil component. So does that make sense?
It makes sense. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Jeff Olson. He's a two-time former Olympic skier and nutrition expert. If you have a question about nutrition, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Athletes are concerned with quick recovery of muscles so they can work out hard repeatedly. Is there something in their diet that addresses that particularly, or should there be, and should non-athletes be concerned with recovery as well?
Well, yeah, great question. The athlete that I would put next to Michael Phelps in the example of eating food is Dera Torres. Dera Torres won 2 silver medals in Beijing at age 40 and went on the next year to win a world championship gold medal at age 41. And she understood that food was a weapon, and I can assure you that her diet was a bit different than Michael's. And Michael, going from Beijing to London, I know improved his diet from the oil perspective. And so you've got carbs, proteins, and fats, and you've got the everything else category. And the everything else is the non-caloric stuff, which is really the stuff, if you think of an iceberg, that lies beneath and it brings the human body to life. So that recovery, human performance happens when we, are at rest during heavy REM at sleep, and when human growth hormone comes out to play, and that mixes with the matter that we've consumed and recreates us. We discard about 300 pounds of cells a year, and so we literally are what we eat. But that oil inside us brings human physiology to life. If you're an athlete or if you're just a civilian, as I like to say, it relates to increased energy, increased better circulation, stronger immunity, improvements in protection of DNA, and human performance is a pregnancy, as an example. That's human performance. Better circulation for a diabetic, that's human performance. And so that recovery process, that adaptation, cells either crash and burn or they stand and deliver. And what causes cells to do their job and work is the oil part. So it's vitamins and it's minerals and it's enzymes and it's antioxidants and it's phytonutrients and phytochemicals and thousands of things inside real, fresh, clean, whole food that bring the body to life.
I was going to get to that. So the oil is the stuff that they tell you to eat when you sit at the table and they make you eat it on your plate when you're a kid. That's the oil. Oil sounds like, hey, oil, but really, I mean, it's the vitamins, as you said, vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and all that kind of stuff. What is it? How did, say, Michael Phelps change his diet?
Well, you know, I think coming off of Beijing, he got a lot of feedback from that expose, and no question he needed to consume a lot of calories. I mean, you can't, you know, run your car without enough calories. What, you know, if you remember, he won a race at those Olympics by 1/100th of a second, and he was age 24. Going into London at age 28, and then Derek Torres competing into your 30s. As we age, the lever of food can impact us more dramatically. And so what's going on as we age and we consume bad food is tiny sort of micro damage at the cellular level that you can't see, touch, feel until it's too late. And so as we age, we peak out physiologically in our low 30-year age. And so beyond that, food becomes more and more important. The velocity of aging, we want to slow that down. You know, we're living longer, but our health span is not keeping up with our lifespan. So that oil, all those phytochemicals and nutrients and vitamins and minerals and enzymes and antioxidants, all of that stuff underneath the hood, just think of it as a lubricant, and it makes the body work better. So one of the concepts, as an example, I talk to coaches about maximizing energy output. That gets into a real geeky conversation about what is inside a cell that makes energy. And we know that the oil part of food brings that to life, protects that, preserves that, and gives its integrity so we can sustain and maximize energy output, you know, for a longer duration. And so that is an example. If you translate that to just weekend warriors and people, if you've got organs and tissues that need more energy, like your eyes, like your brain, like your lungs, those are high maintenance organs. They need to produce a lot of energy during the day. And those nutrient-dense foods, those whole foods, those generally plant foods, they have inside them what your body needs to make that energy sustained in those organs and tissues and cells.
Farley in Columbus, you're on the air with Jeff Olson. Welcome to the show, Farley.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call. And are there certain things that we should really avoid? I know you're going to say don't eat chicken wings and all of that, but I get all kind of mixed signals. I get on the internet and I shouldn't be eating Greek yogurt and raisins are bad for me. And I don't know where I should go.
It's like the red wine thing, right?
Yeah. You know, I don't know. There's so many signals out there. I try to eat a lot of produce and lean meats. And I'm pretty fit. I just don't know. Are there certain things that we think that are good for us that we probably shouldn't be eating?
Okay. Good question.
You know, that is a great question. You know, we live in the information age, and knowledge is just kind of the booby prize, and we sort of live in this world of nutrition, food, diet. It's kind of like Humpty Dumpty. You know, it's fallen off the wall and busted up into 1,000 different pieces. And one of my colleagues and good friends and ski buddies is actually a doctor by the name of Dr. David Katz. He is world-renowned and certainly in America, one of the leading physicians and clinicians and researchers around, you know, what makes the human body come alive with food. And he really leans on Michael Pollan, and he calls this a real dietary bullseye when he says, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. And for athletes, they just got to eat more food. So it's eat food, mostly plants, more food if you're an athlete to service that caloric requirement. So I guess translating it to your question, you know, the eating food part, fresh, clean, whole, you know, pure, you know, that category is pretty straightforward. You kind of know when you're buying processed stuff that has a lot of stuff in it. So that category, you know, as a society, we need just to eat more plants. I'm from Montana. I love a nice steak. And I, you know, I'm about an 80-20 guy in my life. I'd be eating about 80% plants, 20% or 80%, yeah, 80% plants, 20% animal products. And so if you stick to eat food, mostly plants, not too much, that's a dietary bullseye, as Dr. Katz says. And you know, one of the best coaches I ever had said about, you know, he said, I got to come up with a thousand different ways to tell you knuckleheads about a half a dozen things. And if you master those half a dozen things, you'll be a world champion or you'll be an Olympic champion. It's the mastery of fundamentals over time that makes the competitive advantage. And so, you know, if you master eat food, mostly plants, not too much, that's a dietary bullseye, whether you're an athlete or whether you're just trying to maintain vitality as you age.
As a former Olympian yourself, 1988 and 1992, what nutrition advice were you given back then? And how has thinking about sports nutrition changed in the past 20 years?
Well, there's a funny story there. When I back in the late 80s, early 90s, if many of you will remember, we were going through the no-fat craze. And back then, it was all fat was bad, and the no-fat marketing blitz ensued. And so that translated all the way through up into my sport, and my trainer and my coach and my athletic trainer basically told us to not eat peanut butter because it was toxic, which is kind of funny looking back, and that they were just the conventional wisdom at the time was to not eat fat. And so none of us really actually listened to our trainer because we could sort of intuitively
not
knew
eat
that
peanut
was,
butter.
That was kind of bunk. But it was a fun, I remember that because she was very adamant. She was like, don't eat these kinds of fats. They're toxic. So, you know, as knowledge catches up to common sense, it turns out the more we know, the more we realized, you know, keep it simple, stupid. But it's where we stumble, fumble, mumble, grumble, and are humbled is just in the execution of the simple stuff.
Hmm. Tell us, what did you compete in 88 and 92?
Well, I was a Bodie Miller compatriot. I was a speed alpine downhill ski racer. So I raced downhill and super G in the speed events and alpine skiing. So.
What do you make of the changes this year?
The changes to?
Well, the different kinds of events that.
Oh, well, they've certainly added events. And, you know, I think it's been, you know, the downhill, the men's downhill was an amazing course. I think, you know, what's fun about our sport is as technology improves and as sports, human performance, applied science improves, in the end, you know, the simple fundamentals that exist for racers today that make them the best really existed 20, 30 years ago when I was an athlete. There's a few subtle changes, but the core half a dozen skills remain, mm-hmm. and it's just been a pleasure to watch the game so far in Sochi for me.
You know, you say that the palate can adapt to more nutritious food because a lot of people say, I don't like the texture of, you know, kale or whatever it might be, just like the body adapts to more challenging workouts. Can you tell us about that? I mean, it's something that you can adapt to.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, as I like to say, athletes are ruthlessly practical and they will do what works. And what works and what sustains long-term is taste. So if great, healthy food, nutritious food, powerful food doesn't taste good and in your children gives them the gag reflex, understand this, it's a pretty simple principle, but it's pretty powerful to understand. You can train your body. You go and you exercise and physical activity and you adapt to higher ground. You can train your brain, train your mind. You go to school, you get a higher degree and you adapt to higher ground. We've sort of neutered our palates. We've anesthetized our taste buds. And the concept of training taste, acclimating palate, is there's clear science around it, but training taste buds in young children, I think, is one of the most powerful things we can do as parents. You know, it's monkey see, monkey do, and training taste to higher ground and acclimating that palate, you know, that's the only thing that's sustainable, because if healthy food doesn't taste good, you're not going to crave it, you're not going to lean into it, and you're not going to design your life around it. And so taste is really, in terms of what's sustainable, taste is number one. Convenience and price, you know, are obviously on the podium. You know, if it doesn't taste good, you're not going to eat it. So we work with athletes and a lot of people in my work just to help them through some programs adapt and train that palate up.
We just have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you about amino acids as substitute for food. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, amino acids, you know, you put them all together and they turn out to be what's called protein. And you know, amino acids, you know, athletes use what are called ergogenic aids. Ergogenic is nothing more than a sort of a man-made technology that's there to improve your performance. Mm-hmm. That's the work that I do in my day job. We work with athletes with some ergogenic aids, but it's around the execution of fundamentals.
Okay.
So amino acids, whether, you know, athletes do take a lot of those those kinds of things. The challenge is in working with people who know what they're doing, and obviously safety is number one importance. There's, you know, a lot of incidents where athletes have taken things and not known what is in them and been tested and banned for banned substances. So you need to know what you're doing, and they can have an improvement, and that's some of the work we do in our day job. But amino acids, as an example, that's you can get plenty of amino acids if you just eat it in food.
Okay.
But most people don't do that.
Okay. Jeff Olson, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, and thanks so much for having me.
Jeff Olson, he's a two-time former Olympic skier and nutrition expert. Thanks to everybody for listening today on Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.